There are so many reasons why I got into teaching.
One of the best things is the light bulb moment.
When you see a pupil suddenly understand something, that's really, really special.
Every child is so full of potential, and the thing that makes me proudest to be a teacher is seeing them realise what they are capable of.
I don't think any other job can give you the same satisfaction.
That's why I chose to teach.
You could get £26,000 tax-free to train. Search, apply to teach. Selected subjects only, subject to eligibility.
This is Robbie Bach, and now you're listening to the amazing 500th episode of Gamer Tag Radio. Congratulations, guys. Let's get it on.
Ladies and gentlemen. Podcasting since 2005. You are listening to Gamer Tag Radio with your hosts Godfrey, Pete Rock, Paris, Pasta.
I won this club. Come on.
Welcome to episode 500 of Gamertag Radio. This is Paris, riding solo here for the intro, but in just a second, I'm going to be handing it off to Danny, Pete, and Patrick. We have a very special guest for our interview this week, about 50 minutes long. They were able to talk to the former president and chief Xbox officer, Robbie Bach of Microsoft. I don't even want to give too much away, other than to say it was a great interview. Kudos to the guys for being able to do this interview. I thought they had some fantastic questions. And I'll just give a slight hint and say pay extra special attention to his discussion about the early days of Xbox Live, the acquisition of Rare, and he even talks about the X-Boy. So make sure you stay tuned for that, and we'll be getting to that interview in just a second. But before we do, I want to remind you guys to go check us out over at GamertagRadio.com. You can also find us over at Play.it. If you want to find us on Twitter, that's at Gamertag Radio. And of course, our email address is fanmail@gamertagradio.com. Or if you want to leave us a voicemail, that number is 786-273-7GTR. I'm going to shut up. I'm going to hand it over to the interview right now, and I'll see you guys after that.
Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
All right, welcome to Gamer Tag Radio, episode 500. Pete, can you believe this? 500 episodes. That is insane.
It's many, many, many years and many, many nights of just sitting up and talking to you.
Yes. But here's a cool thing. Of course, Patrick is here. Mm-hmm. Patrick, what's
500.
Up? But
we amazing, guys.
Yeah.
Halfway there.
Yeah, but we have a special guest. We've known him for a very long time. Even during the original Xbox days, and I've been working on this for a while now to get him on the show. And even when he was part of Microsoft, I tried, but the PRs always was saying no. It was difficult. It's cool. We have here former Microsoft president and also chief Xbox officer, Robbie Bach. Robbie, how you doing, man?
Hey, good to be on the show with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Cool. And now, Robbie, you also have a new book that's already out now. It's called Xbox Revisited. Tell us about that and how long you've been working on this book.
So I've been working on the book for about 3 years, depending on when you think I actually started. And the focus of the book is taking the story of the creation of Xbox and what we learned about how to develop strategies for success, and then applying those strategies to civic issues, which is a little bit of a novel twist. But in my second life after Microsoft, I'm very focused on how we improve our civic organizations and the things that are going on in our local communities. And I think there's lots of lessons you can learn from business, and in particular from the challenges of Xbox, that we can bring to bear on those civic issues.
And I know you've been working with Microsoft for, I believe, 22 years?
Yeah, I worked for Microsoft from 1988 until the November of 2010. So 22, a little over, it's almost 22 and a half years.
So let's say, I know you are not a huge gamer, but let's be real here. When the original Xbox came out and also Xbox 360, do you think that was like the most stressful time for you during those days working at Microsoft? If so, why?
No question that was, particularly the original Xbox, was far and away the most stressful time. We were trying to do something that was quite difficult. We were trying to build a console from scratch in less than 18 months. We were building a new business for Microsoft, entering a field with some really strong competitors. The team was eclectic. That would be the polite way of saying it. We didn't work very well together, and I wasn't a very complete leader at the time. And, you know, that just led to a lot of difficult challenges, a lot of long nights, and at one point, a letter of resignation from me.
Yes, I know you mentioned that during the book, too. I remember that. So, I mean, but your boss were like, no, you're not leaving.
No, right? My boss at the time was a guy named Rick Belluzzo, who was a president of Microsoft at the time. And Rick was very good at forcing me to step back from the problem and sort of figure out the issues that were underlying the problem. And as these things always play out, the issues were mostly mine, not anybody else's. And once I started to attack those issues and also work with the team to change the way we did our strategy process, things started to come together. And the result of all that work was the product Xbox 360, which was a remarkably better product than the original Xbox and did incredibly well in the marketplace. So you really can take things that are challenging and turn them into great things if you work at it hard enough.
Do you think that the gaming industry would be where it's at right now in 2015 if you and or Microsoft had given up as a result of those first initial signs of failure?
A good question. Some of what's happened, I would say, is in some ways just the inevitable march of evolution and revolution in any industry. But there are a few places where I think Microsoft has had a big impact. Xbox Live has changed things in a dramatic way. And I think it's easy for people to lessen that impact. But think of it this way. Xbox Live shipped on November 15th, 2002. That's before MySpace, and that's before Facebook. It's a social network in the cloud before either of those things existed. And that has changed the way people think about gaming in dramatic ways. Everybody talks about downloadable content and freemium models and things like that. Xbox Live put in a lot of the, I'd say, underlying architecture and business model work and sort of philosophy in the industry around that, and I think played an important role. So I think there are things that would have ended up differently without Microsoft and Xbox, and there's probably a number of things that were inevitable to happen, and maybe they would have happened slightly differently, but they would have happened in any event.
Yeah, actually, good question. You brought up Xbox Live. I'm a huge fan. I've been using it for over a decade, but I noticed how you wrote in the book that originally y'all had planned to have Xbox Live day and date with the launch of the original Xbox, but because of unforeseen, you know, difficulties in setting that up, it took y'all about a year to get it to get out the door and launch. Can you speak about some of those difficulties of, you know, why y'all couldn't get it out at launch for Xbox Live?
Well, to be fair to the team, I would say the idea that we would have Xbox Live at launch was probably in the plan only in the early planning phases. Once we got approval for the product and started to look at what had to get done, I'm not sure many people thought we would get Xbox Live done in time for the launch. But to be fair, the real challenges with Xbox Live were sort of symptoms of challenges with the business as a whole. We didn't have a real committed vision for what Xbox Live should be. Everybody said, oh yeah, we should do online gaming. But that actually doesn't tell you what the product should be. And so we spent a lot of time, and frankly, in the end, wasted a lot of time trying to figure out what the concept should be and having different arguments about what Xbox Live should look at and how it should work out. And it wasn't until we sat down, and I talk about this at some length in the book, and wrote a set of principles for what Xbox Live should be that things started to get orchestrated. And this is part of the strategy process that I write about in the book called the 3P Framework, which is every project has to have purpose, which is a one-sentence statement of what you want to accomplish, principles, which is the way you're going to operate and how you're going to work to make that come alive, and then priorities, which is the things that you're going to do to achieve your ultimate goal. And in the case of Xbox Live, it was really hard for us to get agreement on principles. And once we finally got that agreement, the service itself came together pretty nicely.
I mean, you guys lost $3.7 billion during the first console. How in the world did Microsoft approve for the second console, though? Because that's a lot of money.
I actually think if you do the accounting with the way I would do it, we probably lost more like $5 to $7 billion. But you know, what's a couple of billion dollars between friends? It was the first version was remarkably unsuccessful financially, but you have to remember that there were at least three important things that happened that gave people great hope. First, we had 20 to 25% market share in most markets in the world, with the exception of probably Spain and Japan. So there was market success and market traction. Second, people saw the early success of Xbox Live and realized there was something important there. And third, there was this little thing called Halo that people realized, hey, Microsoft, we can do great games.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there were some indicators of optimism for what we could do. The other thing I would say is that Microsoft's the kind of place that, you know, rarely gives up easily or quickly on things. And I don't remember actually having a conversation with either Bill or Steve about not doing the second version of Xbox. I think the presumption was, hey, we've invested in this a lot. We're committed to it. We know it's hard. We know it's difficult. We see hope in some of the things that I identified. Come to us with a good plan. And that came out of our 3P framework. We had a three-page document that summarized our purpose, principles, and priorities. And I think people looked at that and they thinking technically on the team and said, this is absolutely worth pursuing.
What are your biggest mistake while working on Xbox for both consoles, while working on those consoles and stuff for you?
Wow. That's for me personally, that's a pretty long list. I'm not sure I could narrow it down to just one thing. I think at sort of a high philosophical level, the first thing I would do differently is with the agreement to start the original Xbox, we should have gotten the team on the same page and with the same set of goals much more quickly. Our first party team that was doing Microsoft games was on a different page of the playbook than the console hardware team was, and they were on a different page of the playbook from the software team that was doing all the infrastructure. And that made running the project really hard, and it made the product look, put a lot of seams in the product where people would see it wasn't an integrated concept. So at the philosophical level, that's certainly the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do in hindsight is we would think about console costs much more like we did with Xbox 360. Xbox, the original Xbox, we didn't think about setting the box up to be cost reduced and to manage ourselves through the life cycle at the right price point. And that caused so many problems. If we could have somehow done that differently, it would have made the first generation of the product financially much more successful and would have made things a lot easier.
Do you think that the way that the Xbox performed in Japan contributed to that?
I think the performance in Japan. Wow, what to say about the performance in Japan? that's an interesting question in and of itself. I think the performance in Japan is just a separate thing, mostly. Size of the box made it hard for it to sell in Japan. The original controller we came out was too big for the United States and Europe. It was way too big for Japan. But the biggest issue in Japan was actually around content. It wasn't about cost structure or even size or color of the box or all the other things people tried to tell us were a problem. I think mostly the problem was there's genres of games that sell well in Japan, and those move consoles, and we didn't have those genres. And we didn't have the right collection of Japanese game developers really focused on our platform. And to be honest, I think that's probably still the case. The thing that's changed is that Japanese game developers in the console space probably matter less now than they did in 2001 when we launched the original Xbox. And so, you know, the market is much bigger in North America and Europe than it was at that time. And North American and European publishers, Microsoft always had a pretty good relationship with them, but we struggled to develop great relationships with Japanese publishers, and it wasn't for lack of effort, but we just never sort of figured that out. I don't think it's an easy problem, by the way. I certainly didn't figure it out, and I don't think my predecessors or my successors have done any better. Just a hard problem, and I think it's mostly about content.
Knowing what you know now about the history of Xbox and the way it's performed in Japan, And do you think that in today's economic climate, it's still a viable market, not just for Microsoft, but for other console makers like Nintendo and Sony?
Oh, I'm not close enough to the current data to actually really tell you. I know the gaming market there has done exceptionally well, but it's been mostly focused on mobile, and that the console market hasn't grown anything close to what it has in the United States or Europe. But nevertheless, my guess is, and this isn't based on any data that I've looked at, but my guess is it's still a top six or seven market in the world. You know, Xbox was, when I left, Xbox was in something like 40 countries. So Japan's going to be a market the product needs to be in. You just have to be realistic about the progress you can make and take a long-term view of what you're trying to accomplish. And I think mostly with Xbox 360 and now with Xbox One, the company has done that and continued to invest appropriately, but been realistic about what we thought we could achieve in that market.
Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
This summer has been a very, very busy time for us, and that's why I love to look presentable. Like when we went to E3, I took my Harry's product, shaved over there, and I went to the events, I went to press conferences, all that. Even during podcast movement, you know, I had a big moment with the Hall of Fame award and everything, and I had to look presentable. That's why I love Harry's. Harry's.com was started by two guys who were passionate about creating a better shaving experience. And that's what I use to look smooth. I shave a couple times a week. And let me tell you, ever since I've been using this product, I love it. My skin is very, very smooth, quality, feels legit. Say goodbye to choosing between an expensive brand and say hello to Harry's. High quality blades at a price you will love. Go to harrys.com right now and enter code GTR at checkout to get $5 off your first purchase. Get a month worth of shaving for just $10 with code GTR at checkout. That's harry.com, promo code GTR.
Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
Yeah, Robbie, I actually wanted to switch pages real quick and talk about some of the content you wrote in your book, particularly what I read in chapter 10, because it struck a chord with me, because I'm always very interested in civics and politics, talk about with whoever I can. But you brought up a conversation that you often have with your friend Charles Roskovich, where you said you basically had guys discover the long-lost art of public discourse that you feel just really doesn't exist on the level that it should. What do you believe is the best method for not only encouraging, but fostering more public discourse at the local, state, and federal level? How can people get more involved in this?
Well, I think the first thing that you have to internalize is that most what I call civic engineering and the public discourse that goes along with it, most of that has to happen locally. And if people look and say, yeah, we've lost the art of discourse, look at the Republican presidential debate. Wow, the Republican presidential debate was just it's not even a debate. I mean, it's hard to call that
it's a circus attraction, more or less, at this point.
Yeah, it is, and it's not even that they've lost the art of public discourse. It just wasn't an opportunity to have any discourse. Mm-hmm. And so if you really want to have, you know, really get engaged, my encouragement to people is to start locally and really find things that you can do in your community. I talk to people ask me, you know, so who are the most important civic leaders in the country today? And I would say certainly there's some in the nonprofit world that are incredibly important. But if I was looking in the government ranks, I'd say mayors are probably the most important. Because mayors can actually get something done. They actually live and work in their communities. And the territories they cover are actually manageable, and they can really understand what needs to be done. It's still not an easy job. It may be one of the hardest jobs in the country. But if you look what's going on in with Eric Garcetti in L.A., you look at the last 20 years in New York, you look at the challenges and successes Rahm Emanuel's had in Chicago, and he's had both. He's had both challenges and successes. You look at Cory Booker in Newark. These are guys who have real influence and can have real impact. And I think that's incredibly important. And that's the place, to your original question, that's the place where discourse happens.
Okay, excellent.
Well, one of the things I like about this book, Robbie, is like there's a lot of like behind the scenes stories. about you working at Xbox. But there's one question I always had in my mind about, I know you were involved. Were you involved when Microsoft purchased Rare back then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I visited the farm when it was still a farm.
Okay. So how that came about, and do you see that at that time, was that the right move for Microsoft? If so, why?
The way it came about, I mean, what would always happen, we were always looking for ways to strengthen our first-party studio. You know, one of the big things, one of the big challenges we had from the very beginning is we didn't have big first-party capability. I mean, I talked earlier about Halo and Bungie. Well, we acquired Bungie. And so one of the two ways we could get first-party content would be to sign third-party developers to a first-party publishing deal, and we did a fair amount of that. Or we could look to acquire and actually manage the assets themselves. And it became clear through our connections in the industry that the guys at Rare were interested in changing their relationship away from Nintendo. And they've had such a track record of success that that was an opportunity you had to look into. You know, in my I don't know whether that, you know, financially was an acquisition that actually paid out for the company or not. I haven't looked at the data. It certainly wasn't as successful an acquisition as the Bungie acquisition was. And acquisitions of creative talent are always hard because the talent can leave. So, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I don't know whether I would do the Rare acquisition or not. That's, you know, a difficult question. But I would think very carefully about how to acquire companies where I was confident the talent was going to stay and be excited about the work that you wanted them to do. And when you're, you know, this is true not just in the video game space, it's true in music, it's true in movies. Creative talent's difficult to manage for good reasons, and you have to be thoughtful about making sure you can lead those people successfully. And our track record at Microsoft, I'd say, was mixed. We had some creative talent that we managed very well, and we had some talent that we didn't do quite as good a job with. And my guess is if I really looked at it in detail, I would find some areas of success in the Rare acquisition and probably some places where we probably could have done better.
Mm. Do you think them just focusing too much on Kinect games for like the past few years, you think that kind of hurt them, you think? Or you think that basically helped for the company to promote Kinect out to the masses?
Well, I'm probably not even qualified to answer that question. I think Kinect, what I will say is this, I think Kinect is quite interesting. I think it's quite a cool piece of technology. I think it's produced some very interesting and some powerful game experiences. You know, does it have the capability to be the only controller in the box? Clearly people don't think so, because even Microsoft put both a hand controller, a regular controller, and a Kinect in the box originally with Xbox One. So I think there are some exciting possibilities with Kinect and some challenges. And the company's trying to find the right balance there, and I think I have a lot of confidence in Phil and Phil Spencer and his team, and I think they'll find the right balance.
Oh, cool.
All right. I wanted to shift this more towards a personal question for you, Robbie. What did you learn about yourself, whether positive or negative, as a result of writing the book?
Neither positive nor negative, but just factual, is I learned I love to write, which wasn't a complete surprise to me, honestly. But the depth of my enjoyment was a way better experience than I expected. And it frustrates me. You know, right now I'm doing a lot of work to help promote and sell the book, and it frustrates me a bit because I can't do as much writing right now. And so the first thing I'd say is I discovered I really like to write. The second thing I would say I discovered, which is obvious when you step back, but I'm much more objective about my performance during my time on Xbox now than I was when I was there. And the ability to distance yourself a bit from the subject matter and then come back and literally revisit it, it gives you the ability to be somewhat analytic about it and say, hey, I really didn't do a very good job there. And I'm not sure I would have been smart enough nor mature enough to say that when I was working on the business. But the book gave me the opportunity to be a little bit more objective about it and really evaluate things I did well, things I did poorly, and try to figure out how to do them better in the future. That was incredibly valuable for me.
Yeah. So I guess back to specific policy type of questions. For me, one of my big frustrations with, you know, our electoral college or electoral process or voting process is the large amount of people that, which as you called them, the silent majority, just don't seem to get actively involved. And you have the fringe elements that are the loudest at both ends that get all the attention all the time. So obviously, as you said, you know, if you want to make public discourse happen, you know, about the mayoral local level is the best way to do it. But say, you know, your average day, you know, man or woman, you know, what can they do? And as I like the way you put it, adopt and implement practical proposals for change. You know, what can they do in terms of the smallest scale start to make a difference for, you know, their community and the lives of those around them?
Well, I think it's actually on one level, it seems like a tough problem. On the other hand, I actually think it's fairly simple. You have to find an issue that you are passionate about, that you care about, and invest time and energy in that issue. Now, I'll give you a perfect example. Take the question of gay marriage. If you had gone back if you could go back in a time machine 5 years ago and look and say, what do you think the odds are that gay marriage will be a nationally sanctioned legal activity in 2015? In 2010, I think most people would have said, I would bet 80 or 90% of people would have said, no way that'll happen in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, because some people who were very passionate about the topic and for whom it was personal got involved, they changed the country in a fundamental way in the course of 18 months. Pretty amazing when you think about it.
No, absolutely.
And I think, you know, independent of how you feel about the particular issue itself, it's a case study in local activity. Look, Washington, D.C. and the people in Washington, D.C. were the last on that bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. All of this happened locally. And, you know, there's a number of issues that are working that way. And I think it can be very powerful. And so what I encourage people to do is, you know, what are you passionate about? Are you passionate about education? Okay, well, go to a school board meeting. See what that's like. You know, are you involved in your local PTA? Well, I guess it's now PTSA. Are you involved in thinking about organizations like Teach for America? Are you involved in supporting a school in your neighborhood? It's those simple acts that get you started. I started working with Boys and Girls Club as a coach for my son's first grade basketball team. I'm now on the National Board of Governors for Boys and Girls Clubs of America.
Wow.
That's how these things work.
That's excellent.
It's a really powerful thing, and it's hard to see because it just sort of naturally happens.
Mm-hmm.
But when people get themselves engaged and get themselves started, truly incredible things can happen.
Yeah, I know in the book you talked about X-Boy.
Yeah.
That never had been put. How that conversation came about behind the scenes at Microsoft, and I personally think it was the right move not to work on that project at all, but go for it.
Well, I mean, basically, the so-called X-Boy set of proposals that got made were like 25 other proposals. I mean, we constantly had people making new proposals about things we should be doing. Sometimes it would be a new game. Sometimes it'd be something like X-Boy. Sometimes it'd be a new market we should go into, a new country we should enter. Something like Connect came through the same process where people were constantly incubating new ideas. And so those incubations would work through our process, and eventually we'd have to say, hey, is this something we want to really consider more seriously? And people would come to the management team and they'd present their ideas and we'd say, hey, that's interesting or that's not. And X-Boy, and nobody called it X-Boy in their proposals, but they all had these funny code names that nobody remembers. But in the end, we always talked about it as X-Boy. Those set of proposals were interesting sort of at a superficial level because they were sort of doing what everybody else in the industry was doing. And yet, when you actually sat back and thought about what it meant to go do something like that, it was like starting another Xbox project. And given the fact that the first Xbox project wasn't successful yet, the idea of starting a second Xbox-like project just made no sense at all.
So this took place around the 360 days or during the original Xbox?
Both. But my memory serves me that there was a fair amount of it in the original Xbox and even some of it in the early 360 days. And remember that it wasn't apparent that 360 was going to be successful in the first 18 months of the product. We did well in the first 18 months, but for the first 12 months, we had no competition because Sony and Nintendo hadn't shipped yet. Mm-hmm. And so even in the early days of Xbox, a 360, we had to think of that as a business that was still very challenged. And then, of course, we had our favorite project, the three red lights problem, which made Xbox 360, you know, more challenging. So throughout all of this, and even with the success of Xbox 360, we had plenty to focus on to make that product successful. And I always thought of XBoy as being something that would be a distraction. It turned out it probably wasn't the right product anyway. So we were both smart not to pursue it and lucky that we didn't pursue it. You know, that's an example where I think we actually made a really disciplined and intelligent decision.
Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
DraftKings.com, everybody. You've been scouting players for your season-long fantasy football team for months. Put that knowledge to the test every week at DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-week fantasy football site, where you could start the season by winning $2 million in week one. It's the biggest fantasy football contest ever. $10 million in prizes are up for grabs, including $2 million for first place and $1 million for second. I'm going to win first place. One-week fantasy means no season-long commitments. It's fantasy football on demand. Play where you want, when you want, with the players you want. You've never experienced football like this. Just pick your players, pile up the points, pick up your cash. That's it. This isn't fantasy as usual. This is DraftKings. Welcome to the big time. I can't wait, folks. I am a football nut. I'm going to be locked in from August until February with the NFL and playing DraftKings. So let's go. Let's sign up now. A few preseason games to go before the regular season kicks off. So hurry to DraftKings.com now and use our promo code GAMERTAG to play for free to win your share of the $10 million being given away in week one. Enter that promo code GAMERTAG for free entry now at DraftKings.com. That is DraftKings.com.
Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
But let's talk about that, the Red Ring of Death. I mean, that was a very dark, dark days at Xbox. And for me too, man, that happened to me a couple of times, Sue.
Sure.
Man, that was just crazy at that time, man. But I remember watching an interview with Peter Moore and I think Phil. It was an IGN that talked about, they talked about like all the consoles from the Xbox, Xbox 360 and Xbox One. They talked about that during that experience. And he mentioned how you guys went at the meeting and it was Steve Ballmer was there and it was you and Peter Moore. And you guys were actually talking about, like, look, we have to make this move. There's a lot of consumers complaining about this and it's going to hurt us at the end. How scared were you, Mega? That's I know you mentioned that the original Xbox, you lost a lot of money, but this was also a big, big situation for you guys too.
Yeah, there actually were two super important meetings for that. One of which Peter talked about. I think I know the IGN interview you were talking about. He did this at E3 recently. And so there's the meeting with Steve, which is actually in the middle of a business review. And we were starting to get the customer service issues were starting to mount. And so we had a very important exchange with Steve where he said, look, you guys, you know, do what it takes. You got to get after this and deal with it, face the issue. And then the second meeting happened literally in my basement at our house where the seven of us or six or seven of us who are the senior leaders of the management team got down and made the decision to extend the warranty and effectively replace or repair every Xbox that had a three red rings problem. And those two meetings were painful. They weren't fun. And they were dark days for me personally because I felt like we, at some level, not served our customers and the company well. And yet, in many respects, Three Red Rings, as I talk about in the book, was some of my proudest moments because I was exceptionally proud of what the team did to address the problem. And if you track our customer satisfaction all the way through that Three Red Rings, customers remain excited and satisfied and continued to purchase Xbox 360, even with all those challenges. And we had a good product, and it had a problem, and the team really got behind it and said, we're going to fix this and do the right things for our customers. And you rarely go wrong when you do the right things for your customers.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be the case in that product.
Do you miss the corporate culture after leaving Microsoft?
No, I left Microsoft. I tell people I loved every month I was at Microsoft. I can't honestly say I loved every day. That would be... but I did love every month I was there. And yet, I don't miss Microsoft. And in fact, I don't miss corporate life. I left with an intention and a reason, and that was to go have social impact. And because of that, you know, I really love what I'm doing. And so I don't miss the thing that I used to do. And I was very fortunate. I had great managers when I was at Microsoft. I had some incredible opportunities. I worked on building two great businesses, Microsoft Office and Microsoft Xbox. So I have zero complaints about my time at Microsoft itself. And yet it was just the right time for me to leave. And it worked out well for me. And I'm grateful for the time that Bill and Steve and others gave me to lead some businesses there.
I guess switching back gears to the book, I think it was one of the last chapters, but you were breaking down some of the components of the 3P framework. But I really liked how you phrase it up, where you essentially said your goal is to build, as you said, a supply chain of human capital, which you defined as a motivated group of employees who are ready to pursue that framework with passion and energy. And I like that. So my question is, you know, if there's any, you know, managers and executives listening to this out there, how would you advise them to best begin building this chain?
Well, I think it starts with a couple of things, but it starts right at purpose. And it's the reason why I talk about the 3P framework, kind of starting from page one of that book, or mm-hmm. maybe it's page two or three, but all the way through to the end of the book, because purpose is the goal. It's the North Star. You can't build a team of people designed to achieve something if you don't know what direction you're trying to point them. I mean, you naturally will not hire the right people. And, you know, in fact, in Xbox's case, we had a lot of people who worked on the project in the early days and did some really good work for the original Xbox, but who didn't stay around. Either they left or we asked them to leave for the second version because their interests weren't aligned with that purpose. And so purpose to me is a very real and important thing. And so if I'm a leader, the first thing I want to understand is, what are we trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. Once I know that, and then I move to my principles and I say, okay, so what are the principles under which we're going to operate? Now I can start identifying talent. And I'm a big sports guy. So I think of talent identification much like you would think about it in the context of a team. So you're the general manager. I'll pick my favorite team, the Seattle Seahawks. You're the general manager of the Seattle Seahawks. You have a salary cap. You have to build a team. So you have to identify the most important positions, you put those people in there, then you have to think who complements those people, and you build a cohesive team around that. And I think people have to take that attitude when they're doing work. You can't just say, well, we have these 10 people, they've worked for the company, let's have them go work on this project. It doesn't work that way. You have to say, hey, here's what we're trying to accomplish in the project. These are the type of principles we're pursuing. Who are the best 10 people for doing that? And three of them may be at your company, four of them may be in another part of the business, and you might have to find two or three people from the outside and put that team together. And that's the way great teams are formed.
Yeah, I know you mentioned about organization or culture problem over there at Microsoft, because the team was all over the place instead of one location, how it is now with Xbox at Microsoft. Why the change, and why it took so long to make that move for you guys?
In the very early days, in the first version of Xbox, actually, a reasonable percentage of the team, actually a pretty high percentage of the team, was in one location. And that was actually quite helpful. Now, it wasn't on the Microsoft campus, which was, you know, for the original version, probably a blessing, because it meant we could kind of do more what we wanted to do without people constantly checking in on us. But we were off in a place in Redmond, which happens to be across the street from a gravel pit, pretty nondescript building, and most of the Xbox team was there. Now, over time, as we grew, there just wasn't any place to put us. And so the team ended up in a lot of different locations. And that was a period, this happened during the time of Xbox 360, and just made the business much more difficult to manage. Ultimately, the company sort of caught up with its facilities plan, and we had enough space for the team to be back together again in the campus during the day. And I think location does matter. I think offices do matter. And I think where people work and their proximity to others is important.
All right. So Patrick mentioned earlier about the supply chain of human capital and the motivated group of employees with passion. One of those groups, I would probably say, was probably the most passionate group of employees for Microsoft was some of your PR and media, social media people, the Gamerscore blog people.
Sure.
Microsoft early on had a really good grasp of community and getting the, you know, getting gamers in tune with the Xbox culture. And after a while, it kind of seemed like Microsoft lost track of community. It's starting to build it back now. But can you give us a reason why something like that was discarded? It's kind of felt like it was discarded by Microsoft as not as important as it should be. Can you speak on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. There certainly wasn't anything during the time I was there where we ever thought the community wasn't important. I think one of the things that gets challenging over time is you have to ask yourself which community. Because as Xbox got bigger, there were more than one community that was important. So, you know, in the original version of the product, it was the console for hardcore gamers. And there was no question about that. You know, only hardcore gamers had hands big enough to handle the controller. So that's who we marketed and sold to. But as we expanded our audience, the definition of community gets a little bit more challenging. Look, I mean, there's more time spent on Xbox Live watching movies than there is playing video games. And that's, you know, some of that community overlaps, but there's other people in the community now. So I don't, in my experience, I don't ever recall community becoming less important. It may have appeared that way because we had more communities to manage. That's certainly possible. But I never, to me, I never felt like we said, oh gosh, this community part of our marketing isn't as important as it used to be. Mm-hmm. That was the soul, heart and soul of what we did. So maybe what you're telling me is you can give me feedback that says, hey, we got less good at it. And that's always possible. but there was never any intent for that to be a smaller part of our mix. In fact, I would suspect, I don't know this for a fact, but I would suspect it's a more important part of our mix today than it ever was when I was there.
Robbie, I know before we started recording, we talked about the launch of Xbox, which it was in New York City.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, that was like one of my highlights for me because I've been doing like internet radio since that time, since 2001 and stuff, and a podcast now. It's our 10th year anniversary this year. But
wow.
I still have those interviews that I recorded at Xbox Unleashed, you know, meeting Jay Adler, meeting you guys over there at the launch. It was like a very special moment for me. It was right after 9/11 too. You know, because I used to live in New York City at that time too, man. I know you mentioned that a lot in your book. How was that experience, man? You know, seeing everything that was going on, you know, 9/11 and then working on the console. And then, you know, it was like so many things going on in your life, which you talked about in the book. How was that for you and the team?
Well, New York to this day is still an emotional place for me to visit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I lived in New York for a year in, 1985. I worked at Morgan Stanley in Midtown and then got transferred to San Francisco before I went to business school. So I knew the city, not super well, but I'd lived there and liked the city. But I came back for that press tour on the morning of 9/11, and that morning changed my perspective on New York. It changed my perspective on how I think about the city. It changed my perspective on how I think about the importance of civics. And so New York always has for me a deep emotional experience for me. And think of it this way. In the space of 4 months, I did one aborted press tour, a cross-country drive in a Ford Taurus as a result of 9/11, came back 2 weeks later to do the press tour that I got canceled the first time. And then we came back, you know, another 6 weeks later, maybe 8 weeks later, to actually do this big launch in Times Square in a brand new Toys R Us in a city that was, frankly, still recovering. I think you know, probably this is a sad thing to say, but I think the there was still smoke in the city, literally and figuratively.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that just has an impact on you. There's just no way to get around that. And it was all every range of emotion from fear to sadness to excitement and joy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I go back to New York, I was just there last week. And when I go back to New York, I think about that 3 month period quite a bit.
Mm.
And it's sort of like my parents' generation. Everybody remembers where they were when JFK was shot. I think in my generation, everybody remembers where they were the morning of 9/11.
Yep.
And for me, it's that'll always be an emotional grounding point, an emotional center point for how I think about things.
Yeah, believe it or not, you know, like for me, I would like definitely want to thank you guys, because that was a very stressful time for me too. And, you know, seeing, you know, being part of that launch event and getting the console early, because Jay Adler surprised us. They gave us the original Xbox like 2 weeks early, and we were playing it at home. That helped me. That helped me a lot during that time. So I definitely would like to thank you and the team, even though I'm still doing this with the whole gaming stuff, man. So cool.
Well, there was a lot of we had a long discussion at the time about what was going to happen in the console market that holiday, and whether, you know, given everything that was going on, whether people were going to still buy. And I actually think that the console sold very well that holiday. I think part of it was there was a bit of a cocooning effect where people said, "Hey, I'm going to stay closer to home and I'm going to make my own form of entertainment."
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And I think that's just very real.
What are your thoughts now of the industry now in 2015 overall?
You know, I think the industry in many respects is healthier than it's ever been. So you have to take yourself back, I guess now 2+ years, to before the launch of Xbox One and PS4, and ask yourself what people thought of the game console industry. And people said, "Oh my gosh, it's dying." There was all of this woe is me going on in the industry. And you look now, and I was down at E3, you know, a few months ago. The place is crazier than ever. And the industry has expanded. It's now obviously not just about video game consoles. Gaming on the PC is probably stronger than it's ever been before. Gaming on the phone is a huge deal, even if people can't consistently figure out how to make money doing it. there's all kinds of new ideas. You think about virtual reality and what that can do for the industry. So I think the industry's at a better place than it's ever been. People have this debate about, well, how is the PS4 doing? How is Xbox One doing? Let's forget the competition for a moment between Sony and Microsoft just for a minute. More video game consoles have been sold in the first 2 years of this life cycle than ever before. And it's not close.
Hmm.
That's an amazing statement.
That is amazing. Yeah. Compared to the previous ones? Yeah, big time.
Yeah. And so you ask yourself, wow. And then if you match that to dollars spent in the market, because prices are higher than they've ever been before, you sort of realize that people are really engaged.
Mm-hmm.
It's the video game console is here to stay, as is PC gaming, as is mobile gaming. And, you know, video games has its place right next to Hollywood and to the music industry. And, you know, and even Hollywood and music industry are both going through reformations themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so entertainment is changing, but it's never been, in some respects, never been more healthy than it is today.
Do you see yourself writing more books in the future, man? Because this one's really good, man.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the book. That's my number one goal. And I hope it empowers you and other people who listen to this and read the book to get involved in civics and get involved in thinking strategically about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely plan to write another book. I have some ideas about what that would be about, but nothing clear yet. And I need to stop doing interviews and start doing some writing. So at some point I'll get to step away from the microphone and get back to the keyboard. But I'm hopeful that I'll get to write. And certainly in the interim, you will see, if you go to my website, you will see a lot of blog posts on robbiebach.com where I talk about issues, and you're going to see a bunch more of that this fall, and hopefully that will sort of keep me engaged in writing until I'm ready to really sit down and do something longer and more deep.
Yeah, well, definitely recommend for those listeners out there to go right now and buy the book. You could buy it at robbiebach.com or go to Amazon or any retail bookstore out there. Definitely, I highly recommend it. It's also available for e-books too?
Yes, it will, starting on September 3rd.
September 3rd. Okay, awesome, awesome. Well, Robbie, man, just want to say thanks, man, being part of this interview, man, because it was, you know, we had a great time. Talking about the history of Xbox, you working over there and everything. And also great moments, that you talked about in the book too, man. So it was fun. And the cool thing is too, Robbie, that, you know, this is our 500th episode. So it's like a very, very special episode for us, man. So it's an honor, man, for, you know, to have you here, man.
I'm happy to do it. And congratulations, 500 episodes. That just boggles my mind.
It's a lot of episodes.
Boggles ours too.
That's pretty. Hey, there's no better testament to the health of the industry than 500 episodes.
That's true.
Yep. Very true.
Very, very true. All right, guys, head over to GamerTagRadio.com for more episodes and all that. And make sure to give us a call, 786-273-7GTR. That's 786-273-7GTR. Or email us, fanmail@GamerTagRadio.com. Any things you guys would like to say to Robbie before we wrap it up?
I just want to thank you, Robbie, for getting Xbox to happen, because I think that's one of those moments where, like, I thought I was a hardcore gamer before Xbox came out, and then Xbox came out and I realized, oh, I'm not even down the rabbit hole halfway yet. So really, as soon as Xbox Live, it totally changed my perspective of gaming. I made so many friends. I wouldn't even be part of Gamertag Radio right now if not for Xbox Live and not meeting the right people, making friends with my friends like Danny and Peter. So I just want to thank you and Jay Allard and the whole team that, you know, got this dream off the ground and made it soar, because, man, loved all three versions of the Xbox. One of my favorite game consoles ever. So just thanks, Robbie. I appreciate you guys having the dedication and, you know, the willpower to get this happen and made it a success too. Like, it's all the odds. Everybody's rooting against you guys. How could you compete against Sony and Nintendo? But you guys totally killed it.
Well, you know, it's funny. You said one thing that I think is super important. I appreciate the sentiment for sure. But you talked about team. Xbox is a crazy team effort. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be chief Xbox officer at the time. But Jay Allard, Todd Holmdahl, Phil Spencer, gosh, I could mention, you know, 50 names, Peter Moore for sure. There's a ton of people who had a huge influence on what happened. And it's definitely a team effort, and I think that's still true today. And I think Phil's got a great team, and I think they're going to do great things going forward.
No, just, again, thanks for taking time out to, you know, to talk to us, and, you know, the insights that you've given on that book from a managerial perspective. It's actually helped me out over the last couple of weeks. As I start that transition in my hopefully corporate future here. So again, thanks for writing the book. There's plenty of good tidbits of information to use in a corporate environment.
All right, Robbie, but thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, thanks, Robbie.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, take care, man.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Gamer Tag Radio. Voicemail 786-2737-GTR.
Once again, thank you, Robbie Bach, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to sit down with the guys and talk about your history at Microsoft and your history with Xbox. I thought it was a fantastic interview. If you guys have any further questions for us, anything you might want us to pass along to Robbie Bach, hit us up again. Our email address, fanmail@gamertagradio.com. And of course, our voicemail is 786-273-7GTR. And again, you can find us on Twitter @GamertagRadio. I just want to thank Danny, Pete, and Patrick for doing that interview. I thought it was fantastic. I want to give an extra special thanks to Danny. Gamertag Radio is your baby. You started this way back in 2005. It's a 10-year anniversary, and we're here at the 500th episode. Fantastic job by you. Kudos to everybody that has been a part of this process along the way. I'm just lucky that I was able to jump in when I did, but kudos to everybody on the Gamertag Radio team. Fantastic job with this interview. Fantastic 10 years. I'm saying fantastic too much, but before we get out of here, I want to remind you guys that special guests don't end at 500. Episode 501 is going to be Destiny Talk Radio, as promised. And we have a very special guest coming on to talk about Destiny and the Taken King, which is coming out on September 15th. So stick around next week for that. But until then, I am Paris, and I'm signing off for Danny, Pete, and Patrick, and we will see you guys next week.
You're listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week.